Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Joshua Ferris, author of The Dinner Party and Other Stories, published by Little Brown and Company this month. This is Joshua's first collection of short stories. His debut novel was Then We Came to an End, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. Next came The Unnamed in 2010, and Joshua's third novel in 2014 is To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, which was shortlisted for the 2014 Man Booker Prize. The stories in The Dinner Party have been collected over a period of 10 to 12 years and represent a collection of work that, while distinct and individual, weaves together a set of themes that keeps the reader laughing, puzzled, wondering, and in awe. For example, if you've ever really had a bad day, read these stories and you'll find out what it's like to have a really, really bad day. If you've ever been perplexed about why you made a certain dumb decision, you know, the kind where you slam your heel up of your hand against your forehead, wait till you see some of the decisions these guys make. And I say guys because Joshua is best when he's describing someone like me, a dumb guy who's put his foot in his mouth and rather than trying to get it out, succeeds only in pushing in the ankle and then a portion of the tibia and the fibula. We all have moments when we realize in retrospect, oh, that was the moment that my relationship with Susan began to unravel. Or the moment when you realize if I had just turned that doorknob or had smiled and said hello instead of putting my hands in my pocket and turning away, my life would have been so much different. Having those moments is one thing, and I don't really blame you or myself. Well, yeah, I do blame myself pretty much 24/7. What Joshua does is crystallize those moments or telegraph them in the opening lines of a story so that you read with bated breath, knowing that what is coming is not going to be good, but it's going to resonate. You find yourself either rooting for a character, hoping against hope that he doesn't do the dumbass thing you think he will, or you resign yourself and say, well, this just isn't going to be good. What is fascinating about the process is you find yourself constantly either laughing or trying not to, as these bumbling, foolish guys, some good-hearted, some not so much, meander through life not even knowing what they're getting themselves into. Donald Trump would be a perfect fit as a character in the next collection of short stories that Joshua brings us. So with that, welcome, Josh, and thanks so much for joining us today.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for that nice introduction.
You're welcome. So with the perspective of this book, and knowing that the stories span a decade or so, I watched an interview you did where you were holding up Catcher in the Rye and Nine Stories by Salinger, and you were saying, this is so much better when you point it to Nine Stories. So I was thinking, now like The Dinner Party, for example, 2008, and The New Yorker, nominated for the Shirley Jackson Award. So now you have that, and you have some that are written a little earlier than that. Do you notice the change in your own writing when you have a collection like this?
Oh, yeah, I think. There's a certain, I don't know, stylistic and, personality, continuity through them. But, yeah, I mean, over time, things have changed in all sorts of ways, you know. And actually, that was part of the challenge of going back and revising some of these stories was making sure that I continued to respect the, you know, the preoccupations that I had as the writer who was writing them, even if I no longer really had those preoccupations.
It was interesting too, because, you know, I said thematically, they really are linked. It's as if they are closer in time. And in your acknowledgments, you know, you thank certain people for recognizing that you aren't the kind of guy that you write about. And so it's true that these guys are all, words that I'm not necessarily going to say. It's like, for example, in The Dinner Party, you have a husband, not a good one, and then, I don't know when A Fair Price was published in Vice, but I think it was last year. That guy is just as bad, if not worse.
Yeah. Yeah, these are bad dudes, you know, and it's interesting to me. What I liked about your introductory remarks was the willingness to say, you know, these guys are not that different from Donald Trump. And that doesn't necessarily, I mean, I can just imagine my publisher being like, dude, keep that on
the
low.
You're not supposed to do that.
It's not exactly.
We're trying to sell the book.
Right. It's not exactly a selling point. But I think it's an interesting, the book itself is an interesting, what's the word? It's like, if you give it to someone to read, they will either come back by saying, wow, that says a lot of like true things about human beings, men in particular, or the other alternative, which is, do you really think it's that grim? Hmm. Really? I mean, where's hope? And you can kind of get a bead on what the reader hopes for most, what those two readers hope for most or appreciate most when they're confronting a work of fiction. That is, do they want to sort of see a reflection of the complications that are involved in being human, or do they want a more aspirational story to be told?
Well, it kind of takes a certain amount of courage, which I give myself credit for, to recognize myself in these characters, you know?
And well, I think it does as well. I think it also can't escape me. I mean, I own up to lots of mistakes in my life. I mean, I live as best as I can. I try to be perfect. I wouldn't know how else to live life, but I fail constantly. And the recognition of the gap between what I hope for and what I achieve is where these stories live. I mean, almost none of these stories are autobiographical, none of them. But they certainly partake of my life insofar as a first-person actor and as a recipient of people's behavior. I am constantly reminded of the ways we fall short.
Well, look at it. I mean, it's a great story. I mean, the dinner party. I mean, it's nominated for all these awards. It's a really good story. And when I was saying about telegraphing or not, the thing about the relationship at the beginning is you think, I'm reading it and I'm thinking, this is like the relationship my second wife and I had. We bantered. we bantered. You know, she's really funny. And I'm thinking, you know, this is kind of cool. They kind of get along in this way where, you know, they're joking about duct taping the baby and introducing it to the world that way. And it's like, it's really funny. They have a good relationship. I can recognize that. And yeah. then what happens.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you might have borrowed lines that you and some significant other said. Those lines are okay, right? I mean, in the beginning, the jokes they make, they're okay, right?
You mean morally?
Not morally, they're not okay. But I mean, for a relationship, they're kind of a good
way.
Oh,
yeah.
It's a good bantering relationship.
Yeah, sure, yeah. Yeah, they get along, you know?
Well, yeah, they get along, but what do you do? It's really weird because you they get along and then you just flip the coin, you know? You just, and that's what relationships are. And the funny thing is, the coin flip is based on, well, it's really based on something substantial in the dinner party, but in other stories in the book, it's not quite so much. But I remember with my second wife how it ended. It ended because one night I didn't empty the dishwasher.
Uh-huh.
And that's it.
And it that just, was your job?
It wasn't necessarily my job. I just walked away. And so things went from there to there.
Do you have a third wife?
No, I don't have a third wife. I've promised myself never to save myself and never marry again.
Huh.
Well, I never wanted to get married the first or second time. I wonder if my ex-wives are listening to this.
Who convinced you?
They did. It was an ultimatum. You know, here's the way I look at it. Guys, they start out going out with someone, then they sit on the couch. Then they have, now you have a nice curved 4K TV that's 70 million inches diagonal. You have the remote control. You're sitting there with Fritos, the scoop kind. You got Lipton's French onion dip. You're very, very comfortable. And the girlfriend says, okay, well, we've been together 5 years, so you got to either get married to me or you have to leave. And then the guy has to decide. Chips and the TV and the remote control. You want to give that up, really?
And the dishwasher.
You don't think about the dishwasher. I didn't think about the dishwasher.
I have a great dishwasher at my house. Every morning when I come down and I find all of the dishes cleaned, I couldn't be happier to be where I am. I'm married, I have a kid, and I'm just absolutely delighted by how clean this is. It's a KitchenAid. And for years I had a LG, and it just was crap. So, you know, the flip side of this, which makes itself known a little bit in veins of optimism here and there in the dinner party, is, you know, a kind of contentment, a kind of pleasure. I mean, the guy in A Fair Price, who is arguably the worst of the lot, does see what has worked out for his for himself in his life. And he can kind of, if he weren't constantly stepping on his own foot, he could see what could sustain him, you know? And that,
well, yeah, he can't.
The dishwasher.
But he can't because of Donnie. I mean, you give him Donnie. You give us Donnie so that we can forgive this guy, you know?
Yeah, to some extent.
Yeah,
that's,
you know,
right.
You know,
that's
so
right.
So he's you know, he can't help himself. But it's still this thing you do where you make it so one of the yeah, I think when I was reading one of the stories, I was having not the best day, but after I read it, I felt much better because, you know, everybody else
you
was
weren't going to prison.
Yeah, yeah. And that's how it, you know, you don't say he's going to prison. You don't say anything about what's going to happen to him. But the reader, and this is what's so good about good authors, is like, I wrote the whole story of what happens to him afterwards. It's pretty
right.
easy to do.
Right.
But then you take a story like The Pilot, which I'm laughing at. Am I supposed to be laughing to the whole story?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, good. Because
yeah.
I was.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, between the pigs and the dead kid, I mean, I'm sorry, I was thinking of Joe Pope, sorry, right?
Oh, yeah, you're supposed to be laughing through that one, too, yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking, I don't know why I was thinking, why was I thinking of that? Anyway, yeah, but Joe Pope, he's not a bad guy.
No, that guy is not bad, not at all. I mean, he doesn't actually fit the mold of some of the others. I mean, you've got guys in there who are very, they're good guys, and they are very hopeful about the possibility of changing their lives for the better. They're not necessarily sure how to go about it, and when they finally do decide, they have a way of bungling it. You know, one of the ways in which I wanted to sort of, one of the ways I hoped to make these challenging men appetizing, appealing, is to make sure that there was a lot of humor traced throughout it, you know.
Yeah, it's like, you know, the thing is, in today's world, with me being an old guy, and having texted the wrong girlfriend or having written an email or a text that I pressed send and then wanted to unsend it, you can understand what Joe Pope does. I mean, but he just goes way off, you know, the end of the plank with it. But don't you think it's so much easier to screw up now than it used to be?
Well, I don't formally, maybe, because we've got more devices, but I imagine that, generally speaking, in that regard, not much has changed over time. You know, the capacity for men to screw up has been fairly constant throughout history.
Yeah, I guess people used to reach their arms inside of mailboxes to try to grab letters that they put in there and take them back out.
Yeah. Or any number of things.
Yeah. Well, the thing about Joe Pope is that he knows when he leaves the messages. He knows it was really dumb and he shouldn't be doing it. And he recognizes that. And then he takes these ridiculous steps to attempt to abort her receipt of same.
Mm-hmm.
But what's going on? He's an intelligent guy. He works hard. But he is goofy like me. I mean, I would take the binoculars out and go look. I would stay late and take the binoculars and look around and stuff like that.
Yeah. I think there comes a point in time when you have so much stasis in your life, when things are just so not working out, that you hit a breaking point. You're just like, you know what? I know there are going to be consequences for this, but I can't take it anymore. I can't just keep enduring. I mean, what's the point of that? So you do something kind of reckless and crazy, and then the first thing you think of is, oh, you know, you kind of feel, you just feel like light and free, and you've done something, you've acted in the world, you know, and even if nothing comes of it, at least you no longer have the burden, you know, of just sort of spinning in circles, and then you recognize that that was not the way out. That was not a smart way out.
Well, then there's also the tragic, which is one where you, at the end, you're not laughing, is the pilot. And here's somebody who just doesn't know, he doesn't know what's what. And the closest he can get to knowing what's what is by dressing like the coach. And and the thing that got me is like, you know, it's like at the end of Gatsby when it's "so we beat on boats against the current." It's like when his hands are just flapping barely defensively. It's like that's what happens at the end for those guys. And I and there but for the grace of God go I. I mean, you get to the point where it's like, yeah, I know what's happening. I'm pretty sure this is probably not going to, you know, end well at all, but and I'm trying to kind of stop it from happening, but, you know, I pretty much have just given up.
Well, in that case, you know, it's terminal. He's not getting out of that pool. You know, and I think this happens, I think it happens a lot. I have a 7-year-old, a boy, who, you know, has not really in any significant way tapped into reality yet. I mean, he's still probably 65% certifiably insane. He's all boy, you know, and he just, you put a math problem in front of him and he throws out a number. He's like, I don't know, 519? I don't know. And, you know, step-by-step instructions seem to elude him. Revelation to the way that the adult world works seems to mystify him to no degree. And a lot of the time I'm not so sure that grown men are not any different than that.
I was just thinking the same thing.
I mean, you know, some of the conversations that I've had surrounding the dinner party they've kind of mystified me, because people will say, "Do you really think men are so awful?" And I don't know if that is because there is the hope that people are better, that people go to fiction and read fiction in a kind of aspirational vein, that they're hoping for news from a kind of progressed society, or if they're not listening to the news. Like, is appalling male behavior really news to you? I want to ask them. Because if so, you know, I would be very surprised. So, you know, I don't really, as I say, it's kind of like a litmus test, this story, you know, or these stories. You say, if you read them and find that I'm revealing something that you didn't know about, namely about men, I don't know, my tendency is to want to think that you should pay closer attention.
I guess there should be some group of guys that gets together and forms a group against you saying you're being sexist. And
yeah.
There should be. But then I think it's the problem is you're right. It's like I had this really nice bike, a Liberia bike. It weighed like 19 pounds. So I hung these ceiling hooks in my garage to hang the bike from. But so I hung the bike and it was hung fine. But then like a guy, I thought, I wonder if this bike is strong enough. I mean, I wonder if these hooks are strong enough up there. So I decided I would hang from the bike to see if it was strong enough. And, of course, when I hung from the bike, the hooks came through the ceiling because I hadn't put them in right. But if I hadn't hung from the bike would have stayed there for 100 years perfectly fine. But I had to do it. It's like you said, yeah. I had to take this action. But it was, like, born of stupidity.
Yeah.
And that's it. Like, you have the guy in Fragments. Hey, how come you changed the title by Fragments anyway from the Fragments?
From when it appeared in The New Yorker?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I wish I had an answer for you. I remember doing it, but I can't remember the thinking. I'm sure it was quite wise, but beats me now. I don't know.
Now, he's a guy that's like, there's nothing really wrong with him. He's just in love, and then again, because of technology, just what I was saying earlier, because of a device, his entire life, as my friend would say, his world is rocked, and which pulls the rug out for him in a lot of different ways. And he acts in this child, actually, when you think about it, doesn't he act in a very childlike way?
Yeah, he does. I mean, there's no confrontation. He just sort of retreats and hopes for the best in a way. Wanders around lost, doesn't know how to either confront his wife for the affair that he thinks she's having, or do anything, you know, kind of take action. And I think that's kind of like conflict avoidance is. It comes very naturally to us from the moment that we're born. We don't want to deal with it. We also don't want to be hurt. I mean, I think he's trying to conserve his appetite for hurt.
But he wants to. But he wants to hurt in a way. He wants to hurt her in a way. But then the last scene, it's like, well, then he's going through the pictures with this stranger. You know, it's like, I don't know. That was a very poignant story. I really felt for the guy. I don't know. But then on the other hand, in The Stepchild, that guy is so bad you kind of like him.
That's a wicked little fairy tale, basically. It's like an inversion of a fairy tale, you know what I mean?
It is.
I think to conceive of that guy as a real human being, I mean, he's a monster, you know. I mean, he's like really, really a bad dude. I mean, the guy in A Fair Price, it's going to be hard pressed to beat that guy. But the guy in The Stepchild is a
what?
I think he's a monster, really. I
mean, yeah, but you give him this great advantage. You give him this superpower, right?
Which is?
You know, oh, I love you. I love you in that, you know.
You mean as a seducer?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a great seducer. Yeah. Yeah. And you want to defer to his seductions. Everybody does, I think. I mean, ultimately, that's the kind of point, you know, like how willing people are really willing to be seduced. And it's extraordinary that no one really realizes.
Yeah, she really is willing to be, she wants to be seduced.
She absolutely wants.
And she wants to be seduced while she's got all this stuff going on in her little apartment.
Yeah. I mean, maybe because of that stuff, but yeah.
And he wants to be forgiven by dinner time.
Who doesn't? Dinner sounds like the reason that you and your second wife no longer.
All right, I should never have said that to you. I should never have said it on the air. But it's like, you know, he's the kind of guy, you know, if you're having problems in your marriage and you go to a counselor and you've been really mean to your wife, but the counselor says, you know, perhaps you should, you know, think before you act and perhaps count 20 seconds, and the guy goes, you know, you're exactly right. I've been really unfair to Gwen, and I need to really step back and reevaluate this. And then he goes home and does the same thing. That guy's kind of like that. But she just doesn't know what to do with him, though. She seems like she loves him.
Who's this, the wife?
The wife, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, the wife loves him. I mean, for every jerk, you tend to find somebody standing there willing to forgive them. It's mystifying to me, but, you know, I mean, my guess is just as the guy in Fragments doesn't want to be alone and doesn't want to confront hurt and doesn't want to be left, it's the same with the wife in The Stepchild. I mean, people have an extraordinary amount of extraordinary capacity for outrage, for forgiveness, really. I mean, what's the alternative? The alternative is brave change, you know, radical change, radical reestimation of anything that might be worthwhile, and that's very hard to do. There's a lot of talk right now, you're probably tapping into it, about can Donald Trump change? And it's, I find it extraordinary how often we've been debating this. And we've been debating this for almost 2 years. When's he going to change? When's he going to become sort of that guy that we're always expecting to wake up and see? It doesn't happen time and again.
No, it's not going to happen. I just want him to spell counsel wrong the same way every time. Like this morning,
you're asking for consistency.
Consistency in his wrongness.
Right.
This morning he spelled it C-O-U-N-C-E-L. Last week
right.
It was C-O-U-N-C-I-L.
Right.
I just want to get the S-E-L, and then they correct it afterwards, like an hour later.
Yeah.
It's the weirdest thing.
Well, I guess as the president of the United States, you don't want your errors to be permanent.
Well, on Twitter, I guess they aren't. Either way, it's all gone. It's just, you know.
Yeah.
And once I start talking about Trump, it ruins my whole day. And I've decided, you know, I've been doing it since November, and it's driving everybody around me crazy, and myself, too.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your espionage story, Life in the Heart of the Dead.
Yeah.
So this is a different story. This is different.
Yeah, it is different. It was different from conception. It was different. Everything was different about it. It's a recent story.
It's like, you know, the guy is also reprehensible in the ugly American kind of way.
Uh-huh.
But the interesting thing I found was that he was kind of a catalyst for the tour guide. The tour guide seemed like he had a sea change, like he understood things differently because of this guy.
Yeah.
And then at the end, which I won't give away, that guy, he really reminds me of Lurch from the Addams Family.
Yeah. I stayed at a hotel, and there was a guy who was like that. I mean, that was taken from life. I mean, he was fine. He wasn't
right, but he had that look.
Actually, and this is in keeping with stories of appalling male behavior. He was worse. I was in Prague because I had my book was being published, and I came to do a reading and a couple of other things. And my editor came to get me that morning, one of the mornings. And was sitting there and had asked for me, and for some reason in English. And so this fellow, who was extraordinarily big, he's probably 7 feet tall, was talking to a colleague. He was the bellman, and he was talking to the front desk guy. And when I came down to the lobby and my editor and I walked out, my editor turned to me and said, "He's the worst man I've ever heard." He didn't know, I guess, that my editor was Czech. And could understand him as he was speaking, and he was talking about how he was, how many women he was sleeping with, and the ways in which he was doing it, without them knowing, and any number of other sort of grotesque details, in ways that now we've become accustomed to understanding that men in power speak, or men speak, with the Access Hollywood tape that was leaked, that sort of thing, and it was very distressing to my editor. I could tell how upsetting he was a man, but he was not accustomed to hearing such awful things. And I couldn't fit that into the story. It was distracting when I tried, so I left it out. But it is illustrative, I think, of the ways in which men can speak very, very badly when they're being honest.
The story is a mystery. You don't know.
Tell me why.
Because he's I can't, because if I do, I spoil the ending. It's okay in short stories, I guess, to spoil the ending, but I don't really want to, because of the last words that Lurch says. You know, it's like, okay, well, why is he, and exactly what would have happened, what could have happened, unless I misread it. I don't know.
What could have happened
to him?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think you know, though, that he's made it back, don't you? I think you know he's made it
Yes.
Do you know he's made it back to America? You do. He's come back.
Yeah. But by far, it was really funny. When I was reading that story, someone texted me and said they were going to Prague and should they go on the bridge while I was reading that story.
Huh.
It's a weird thing.
Yeah.
But by far, the worst day ever any guy has ever had in his entire life is the guy in A Night Out.
Yeah.
I mean, how could you make it so bad? It's impossible that you could have a day that bad.
Yeah, it's a nightmare. It's for sure a nightmare. You know, a lot of my stories, that's what my hope is to, my design is to make the story seem very much like a lucid waking dream. And sometimes those dreams are aspirational and sometimes they're nightmares. And in this case, he's having the worst day of his life. And I guess, you know, I mean, if you look back at it and you see how punished this guy is, it's okay. It's okay because he's really an irredeemable dude. He lies, he cheats, all the while, even though the story doesn't come out and make this explicit, he also believes himself to be quite entitled and above punishment, above deprivation and consequence, really. And
yes,
the story is extremely aware of how that is not the case.
And it's also interesting how you stick in that Tiresias guy, you know, the guy who always tell him about the lottery three times. That was pretty good. But then I felt horrible for Sophie. I mean, because she's the nicest person around, and she has to do what she has to do. But
yeah, I mean, it's and he's done it to her. I mean, he's the one that has
she would never
prompted her to act in this way, and so he's continuing to kind of, you know, wreak havoc in the world, even though he's claiming to want redemption.
Yeah,
Yeah,
there's a couple things you do. One point he says something like, you know, I know I shouldn't be doing this, but then he lets it go. And then Sophie's idea of the sure thing, you know, how much meaning there is. And then, there's actually in that story, there's two horrible guys, you know? The guy at the bar.
Yeah, the guy who's...
He's just a regular. You're making, you know, that's where this group of guys that's protesting your book would protest that too, because it's.
They wouldn't like him, would they?
No, because you've stereotyped all men as being like, I'm talking to this beautiful woman, but she's not a sure thing. And this woman says she, you know, then there's a bulldozer over there, you know. Yeah. How dare you?
Yeah. It's ugly. It's ugly. You know, there's a common belief among frustrated men that women have it easier in the game of love, because all they have to do, I guess in the crude parlance, is hang a shingle up, that they're available and men will flock. I am extremely dubious of this proposition. But I used it for this dude who flees with Sophie at the end, who basically abandons a woman in need. I mean, there's another woman in this story who's actually in need. She needs a job, and they've agreed to meet, and he just abandons her and takes off with somebody who has solicited him, and it's not a good scene. That story, if it weren't, I mean, I took great pains for the story itself to be totally aware of the awfulness of these men, and it's my main job in that story is to do that, because not only are they seeking, the main character in particular, seeking redemption, completely undeserving of it. And that's kind of about as far as I could take it. I mean, I did it in A Fair Price, as you say. That guy doesn't turn out so well. He's a bad dude as well. But what happens in A Night Out is it's about as terminal as it gets in terms of, like, awfulness, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. It should make you feel horrible.
Yeah.
it's, you know, but there is that thing, you know, I mean, like, you know, if a guy walks into a bar and there's women at the sitting at the bar and he says, hey, any of you, you women want to go home with me? Or he could easily get arrested. But if a nice-looking woman walks into a bar and asks all the guys at the bar, hey, does anyone want to go home with me? She's, you know, a different, there's definitely going to be a different result. I mean, you can't argue with that. And that's what you're saying. I mean, that's
I'm saying that, but I'm also saying, I guess
you're saying
I'm
it's
also
not
saying
true.
That I'm also saying that in a way, that thing that you did, that dichotomy, is like a male fantasy. I'm not sure how often it actually happens. And the reason it doesn't happen, either one of those, the man coming into the bar and saying it, and the woman coming into the bar saying it, is for any number of reasons, but men fantasize about them happening and think about what the difference is. And I'm not actually sure that it would ever happen in reality. So it is actually a comment, I think, on the ways in which men think. And I'm not above that thought at all. I think it's a comment on how men think and the differences between men and women, and also the differences in which, you know, they have to sort of confront their own limitations and the ugliness of those limitations, and the ways in which I think men feel as if women are more entitled to men, that their entitlement is what makes them bitter, as if, you know, like, why can they enjoy their life just because they're women, and I'm a man, and I can't do anything, I can't get anywhere in this life. And I think that sense of entitlement is you know, embittering. And it leads to violence, and it leads to misogyny, and any number of things.
Well, to continue being sexist, I think basically women are too smart to spend much time fantasizing silly fantasies like this, childish fantasies like this. It's like, you know, if women ran the world, rocket ships would be shaped like flying saucers. They'd be much nicer looking. You know, it's just like an obvious thing. Everything wouldn't be phallic. And guys just, you know, it's a genetic imperative, I guess. I'm just digging myself into a deeper hole here. This is hard.
Well, I you know, to be honest, I also think there's a self-survival that women have. They know if they go into a bar, there's a danger there, and you know, I don't know too many that would want to subject themselves in such a raw and unthinking way to the potential for violence against them. You know, I mean, it's not at that point. It's a fantasy for men. It's a nightmare for a woman to think of it. You know, like the men. I know guys that are like, oh, you know, go into a bar, you set out the situation. You're like, oh yeah, I know what's going to happen with those two. The differences between the man and the woman. But the women will fantasize about it in part because they're like, that's a damn nightmare. I'm not doing that. I'm not even thinking about that.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? You know, it's funny. That leads me into, well, I think I've covered all but two. So, but if you go to The Breeze, which is the most, magical realism, the closest you get to magical realism other than the fairy tale one, in The Breeze, which is kind of like a Sliding Doors kind of story, things happen and things don't happen. But it was like I said in the introduction, it's all about going back and trying to undo the thing that you did so things will be better. But you really don't have that opportunity in life. But in the story, the opportunity exists. And it happens over, and you allow it to happen over and over again. And at first, it was kind of confusing. I was a little bit confused. But then it becomes really clear and self-consistent. That must have been a hard one to kind of shape up.
Yeah, it was hard to anticipate the reader's reaction as the story unfolded. You know, to what extent did I need to be explicit about one change or another, and to what extent could I, you know, rest assured that the reader was following along? And I think that gets worked out fairly early, but in the composition of it itself, it was, you know, a back and forth between the writer and me and the editor and me. You know, I didn't know, but the rules get ironed out, and then it becomes really about the luxury that one has in narrative form to form the night. Everyone's spent a bad night that they'd like to have over, and it's a possibility in the story. And
it's fun. It's like the end of the book, The Magus by John Fowles. The last line of The Breeze is the most uplifting line in your book, I think. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. Yeah.
And it made me really happy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad. That's good news.
Yeah. And then you have, and I don't know where the hell this story came from, you have Ghost Town Choir. And you do stick in a jackass, There is a jackass. There is a guy jackass in the story, right?
Yeah.
You can't help yourself.
No.
He's just there. He doesn't even need to be there, really. Well, yeah, you do.
I have an entire childhood full of these people, so I keep pulling from them.
But the thing about what you do in this story is then you have a mother who takes on some of the attributes that the guys generally have in the story, and then you have a little boy who's stuck at the end. And it's an interesting way for it to kind of end because, it's basically, well, do you have any suggestions? And then he's ready to become the man that he's going to become based on him being in the front seat with his mom in the new car. He's getting ready to set off on the journey that's going to either turn him into one of your guys or not, right?
Yeah. I hope not. I have a lot of fondness for that little kid. I hope he's better than that.
I think he seems strong enough.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out in the sequel.
Oh, there's a sequel.
No.
It's a scoop. Why don't you write a sequel where all the guys are really nice guys. Like that episode of Seinfeld where Elaine meets those three guys that are like George.
But nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll think about it. I don't know how
it would be really boring.
Compelled I'll be, but I'll think about it. Yeah.
It would be boring unless you did something. I don't know. No, I think to create, there's a lot of energy in these stories. There's a lot of kinetic energy in these stories. A lot of it is not potentiated, I guess would be the word. I mean, a lot of it doesn't, other than maybe the suitcase going down the street, a lot of it doesn't really end up like being someone, although there's a frying pan, there's, things thrown in that story, but a lot of it is just all what happens in somebody's mind. Like in the morning when he wakes up on the couch and he goes, why don't you go look at her office? I did that one too,
Mm-hmm.
It's not that it's passive. There's a lot of energy.
You mean stuff that is happening off the page?
I mean, it's like he's done all this stuff. He's spent a night doing all kinds of incredible stuff.
Yeah.
And yet, just like in The Fair Price, you let it go. You said it. You said he's going to jail. You said that to me. So.
Yeah.
But he doesn't go to jail. I have to take him. I have to take him to jail. I mean, because you didn't. And so there's a lot of that. Like he's laying on the couch and I'm thinking, what in God's name is going to happen to this guy?
Yeah.
And he says he thinks that not much is going to happen. He thinks they like him and he works hard and he's going to be okay, right?
Yeah. Well, a lot of these guys, a lot of these guys are fairly full of illusion.
Do you have a therapist?
Me? No. Believe it or not.
I guess this is your therapist.
I'm fairly well adjusted, actually, believe it or not. I mean,
I don't think you can say that about yourself.
You don't think?
Well, you did, but I mean, yeah, you seem fairly well adjusted in your interviews and all.
I mean, I it's not like I don't have deep sort of, screwy thoughts and, all sorts of ways I'm like, oh boy, you need to work on that, a little whatever. But, I have a really, nice life and, I don't know.
Yeah, you seem very happy. You have a good sense of humor. You write well. You have a 7-year-old son who you love.
A lot of those things, you know, a lot of the things that are dark about my thoughts and neurotic thoughts, and a lot of that stuff gets channeled into this work. And I think in that way, there's a way you can be happy and or at least very content. You know, you take all the stuff that, you know, actually the thing that gets me the most is the state of the work. Like, is the work that I've done that day, is it good or bad? And that's the thing that affects my mood the most and will determine, you know, how happily I will deal in the evening hours with my wife and son. You know, like, has it been a good day? And if it hasn't, God, I'm probably going to be, you know, shorter with my son. I'm going to want him to get in the tub earlier and to bed earlier. And, you know, I might have 2 glasses of wine instead of or 2 beers instead of the one. And, you know, I'll be more tired, whatever, you know. But it is actually the work that's going to determine that, the state of the work, more than it is, you know, I don't know, the grudges that I hold against my stepfather.
Well, so the work is really important. I mean, so if at the end of the day you've had a bad day at the office, you take it out on your wife and kid.
Yeah, absolutely. Who else is there? I don't have any other choice. They signed up for it. Well, not my son.
Yeah, but the reason why you're well-adjusted, I think, is because you really appreciate the simple things. I mean, the dishwasher thing. I mean,
yeah,
if that makes you so happy, you must be happy all the time.
Well, no, because, you know, as I say, you know, the work is, the quality of the work is variable, and so the response to the work is, and so, you know, I also think it's very, very, when you're doing a lot of writing, when you are a writer, when you're going through the world as a writer, you're aware constantly. You're very, I mean, that's what it is to kind of like be a writer, is to live aware. And that awareness, that hyper-reality, hyper-attention to things does not make for easy living. You know,
no.
It usually makes for, anxiety
generally, you always have someone talking to you. At least I do. I mean,
yeah.
I walk around and whatever I'm doing, there's somebody out there who's watching me doing it and commenting on it.
Yeah.
That's why I do have a therapist.
That does not make for easy living.
No, it doesn't.
So I actually just try to turn that off. You know, I funnel it into the writing, and then when the writing is over, I try to be okay with not thinking. Thought is the enemy.
So do you have to actually, like on your dishwasher, do you have to rinse them pretty well before you get this crystal clear glasses with no spots on
them? Well, see, that's the thing, man. No.
You,
I mean, I do a fairly okay job at it, but I don't have to be like super diligent. And then in the morning, they're all clean. I don't know what could be better.
And it's a KitchenAid. Those are regular dishwashers. It's not like a Mealy or
it literally cost me $9.95.
Well, no wonder you're happy. Anybody would be happy with that.
That's right.
Does it have that thing on the top where the silverware lines up in a line, or do you just stick it in a little thing?
No, stick it in a little thing.
Yeah, so it's a regular dishwasher. I think you might be deluded. I think your standards are too low.
I don't deny. I would not. I don't doubt it. I'm sure I am.
See, if only I had emptied the dishwasher that night. Who knows what I would be doing now?
Not talking to me. You'd be enjoying your 20th wedding anniversary.
We almost had one, I think. I'm really old. I'm going to be 65 on Sunday.
Wow! Happy birthday.
Thanks. Well, this was fun. I liked it.
Yeah, it was fun for me too.
Yeah, we talked about every story, and we talked
about
Donald Trump, and we talked about dishwashers and how guys are jackasses, and that's pretty much it.
Covered a lot of ground.
We did. Okay, next time I'll catch you before it becomes paperback. That'll be my goal.
Awesome.
Okay.
Awesome.
All right, Josh.
Thanks, Sam. Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you, too. That was Josh Ferris, and another one of those interviews where I relished the thought that I have this opportunity. That wasn't put really well. That was another one of those interviews where I'm really glad that I have the opportunity to talk to authors, especially someone as talented as he is. And his books are amazing. And like I said, this is a great way to start out because it's short stories, and short stories are always fun to read. I love short stories. But Then We Came to an End is an incredible book. The Unnamed is an incredible book. And To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. These books are books that are picked on lists of the best books of the year over and over again. So anyway, I really enjoy talking to him. And the stories are, you know, it's true that they are about guys and how bad they are. So like I said, maybe there'll be a group that rises up against him because of this. But anyway, join us every week. That's what it says here. And the reason why you should join us every week is I got Matt James, this incredible professor who wrote this book, Collecting Evolution, The Galapagos Expedition That Vindicated Darwin, which is great. It's about this 1905 expedition to the Galapagos before the San Francisco earthquake, where these guys, these scientists, collected 68,000 different types of species of birds and fauna and flora and tortoises, and it's really good. And then Jonathan Safran Foer will join us to discuss his critically acclaimed novel, Here I Am, which is just out in paperback and is on our front table, and I highly suggest that you buy that book because it's in paperback, so it's cheap, and it's a really, really good book. And then we have Catherine Scott Clark, who's going to discuss her book, which is amazing, The Exile, the stunning inside story of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda in flight. The reason why it's amazing is because it's so well-researched, and everything it tells you is exactly the opposite of everything you've ever heard. And I'm really looking forward to that one as well. So thanks as always for being here, and hopefully you'll be back here next week for another edition of The Avid Reader.